Lindsey Brown is with us today, and he is speaking on, the, like I said in my prayer, the challenges and the trends of the church globally around the world. So can I just ask you a couple of questions maybe
sure,
for people
ahead.
To get to know you a little better? So what brings you to the States?
Well, I've been speaking at the Billy Graham Center this past week about the global church. With a number of church leaders. So that was the initial invitation. But I'm also a member and have been for the last 25 years of a church in South Wales, which you have a developing relationship with, Highfields Free Evangelical Church. And as the Billy Graham Association kindly paid my airfare to come over here, it didn't cost me anything to come from the East Coast over here as part of the ticket. So because of the growing link between the two churches, I thought it would be nice to come and spend a day seeing your situation and connecting with some of your folks. I did meet Fred in Cardiff a few months ago, but he was so jet-lagged, I'm not sure he recognized who I was. And we sent him off to bed, actually, 10 minutes after we met together.
That's Fred Beasley for us.
Yeah.
We know. So we could tell from your accent you're not from here, and you're from Wales?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. So... look forward to hearing what you have to say, and were you going to have some questions possibly?
Yeah, if we have time, that'll be fine.
Okay.
That'll be great, yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I have two responsibilities in my work. I've been working with university students now for, this is my 38th year, and working with, in the States you call it, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. That's part of a global movement called the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, with about 500,000 university students involved around the world. So it's been my privilege to travel to, I think, 120 countries or more over the last 30 years. For many of those, I was the international director. And then in recent years, I've been seconded to the so-called Lausanne Movement, which is an organization or movement that came out of a congress in Lausanne, Switzerland in 1974, hosted by Billy Graham. It was a very important global congress of evangelical leaders who gathered together to look at the question of how do we communicate the gospel at the tail end of the 20th century. And I was part of the leadership team that organized the third Lausanne Congress of World Evangelization, which took place in Cape Town, South Africa, just about 3 years ago. And shortly, I'd like to give you an overview of some of the things that we heard in that gathering, where 5,500 leaders came together from 198 countries, and it gave us a good picture of trends and developments and challenges in the global evangelical church. Now, I won't be talking about all churches. I'm focusing on challenges and developments in the evangelical church. When I use the word evangelical, it's another word for being aspiring to be biblical in our focus. It's not a new word. Some people try to say it was invented in the Reformation, but I've done some research on this, and it clearly was used in the second century in debates with heretics like Marcion. 180 AD, it's mentioned. So the word evangelical was used to describe authentic Christian belief and practice very early on after the New Testament. It just means gospel people. But before I speak, I want to introduce you to friends who are here with me. Jonathan Stephen is the principal or the president of the only evangelical seminary we have in Wales. It's called West Wales Evangelical School of Theology. He's joined by his COO, Joel Morris. And before Jonathan took up this role, he had a senior responsibility of acting as the general secretary or the president of the Association of Evangelicals in a group called Affinity all across the UK. So I thought it would be interesting for you if you could hear his perspective, his take on challenges facing the British Evangelical Church, because people often say that what happens there will come here, maybe you're about 10 years behind in terms of the elements of decline that we faced and some of the challenges of nominalism. So I thought you may be interested to hear from Jonathan his take, because he has a very good overview of what's happening in the UK and a little bit about the seminary. So over to you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. Is this It's on? Great. It's a great privilege to be here. I've already spoken in one class. We were made incredibly welcome. Lindsay here has introduced me. He's also one of our board members at the school, West. And we already have connections with you here at Scottsdale through various ways. We're just 17 miles up the road from Highfields Church, and we've always been very much partnering with them in different ways. And I just want to say a big thank you to, I don't know any of you in this class were at the European Leadership Forum, the ELF, in Poland earlier this year, but Scottsdale folk make up a huge component of people who serve to make that whole thing possible. And that's a tremendous thing that comes from Scottsdale. So I want to thank you for that. Also, it's a great privilege for me to be here in Wayne Grudem's class. Not only do we use Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology as our major textbook when we do systematics at West, but also he's a great friend of mine. And when I first came to the college about 7 years ago, he was very, very gracious, gave us lots of commendations and so on, and got us a bit noticed. So we've always been grateful to Wayne, and I never thought I'd be speaking in his class, so that's great. Just a little bit about the scene. I was in pastoral ministry in what for Britain is quite a large independent Baptist church west of London for about over 20 years. And I was also president of the FIEC, which is the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches, and also in a group of about 1,200 churches. I was director, as Lindsay mentioned. And that gave me an opportunity to visit in every corner of the UK. So we like to think of Wales as being the very heart of the British Isles. You've got England to the east and the south, you've got Scotland to the north and Ireland to the west, and there at the very heart of the British Isles is Wales. And Wales, of course, is a place that has always punched above its weight spiritually. A little country of just about 3 million people, and yet over time have been many, many missionaries that have gone out. The Lord has blessed Wales with a whole series of revivals over the centuries. And emitting from that, there have been people who have gone around across the whole world. And I'll tell you about a connection there, a particular connection, just in a few moments' time. But the situation in Britain is spiritually pretty grim. And I'm sure you've heard quite a bit about this, but I still meet people when they come to Britain or come to Wales, they're often still surprised at just how depressed spiritually the nation is. I think they expect more. I mean, no nation has been more blessed than Britain. The sheer heritage, spiritually, evangelically, and gospel witness terms of Britain is unparalleled. The number of preachers, theologians, you've only got to think of the Puritans, Wesley and Whitfield, you go Spurgeon, you go on and on and on. And just an amazing list of people, and we are so privileged as a nation. And I think people expect that when they go to Britain, they're going to see some real evidence of this heritage still current. And the sad thing is, of course, that's been swept away for various reasons. And some of them are reasons are very, very complex. But I would certainly say without any hesitation that Britain and Western Europe are the hardest mission field spiritually that exists in the world today. It's not obviously the most physically dangerous, but I think spiritually in many ways it's the most dangerous. We have many missionaries. When I was a minister of the church, we had many missionaries around the world when they came back on furlough. Some of them just in tears, finding out how difficult it was to continue seeking to witness for Christ where we were. And it is really, really tough. And certainly where we are in Wales, we're right on the doorstep of one of the most severely deprived socioeconomically areas in the whole of Europe. You wouldn't expect that to be the case in the UK. You might think somewhere in Eastern Europe, but it's one of the most seriously deprived with all the attendant social and other problems there. And we're on the doorstep of an area of South Wales valleys that used to supply the world with coal. And Cardiff, the capital of Wales, used to be the greatest exporting port in the world. And yet all of that industry, the coal industry, everything else, the industry, has all been taken away, left with a very depressed people who have been robbed of their dignity, have no work opportunities, and with all the attendant social ills that brings. We have a project from the college which we call Valley Commandos, where we're seeking to train and facilitate people to go into these areas and seek to develop new kinds of churches. Because what's needed is not just the static model of the church, which seeks to be attractional, bringing people in by events and various other things. Now, in this post-Christian world in which we live, we've got to be much more New Testament. We've got to be missional communities. We've got to be people who go out into the world and seek to model the Christian life and do what they can to show what Christianity really means in practice. Because if you just have an event, if you just present the gospel in a very simplistic and naive way, which in many ways God was graciously pleased to bless for many, many years in Western society, that no longer washes. It's no longer effective. It's no longer possible. And so we have to teach people in a new way. So if we see that how church needs to be done in a post-Christian society needs to change, so obviously we need to recognize as a college or as a theological seminary, we need to change as well. No good us saying to the churches, you've got to do it a different way, and we stay the same because we were part of the problem. And so to me, when I was called to be president of this seminary, I went with a really clear and powerful vision of what needed to be done. And I wanted to see the whole of this seminary work changed and transformed so that we could truly equip and arm men and women to be a new generation of leaders taking a gospel into a post-Christian world. We certainly don't have all the answers. If you're going to an unevangelized area of the world, if they still exist, we've had centuries of experience, at least know how to approach it. Nobody has had centuries of experience. No one's had even decades of experience of knowing how to go into a post-Christian society. And so we're having to develop, think very quickly on our feet, root into the Word of God, because obviously the Bible has all the answers here, and seek to find radical answers in the Scriptures as to how we need to do this. And that's what we're seeking to do as a college. So we've got a broad vision. We're reshaping what it means to be a theological college. We believe we're doing something which is very radical, and I'm not sure, I think it may be even unprecedented in what we're seeking to do. We're certainly aiming to be the best theological college and center of excellence in Europe. And we're there on the doorstep of the church that you're already supporting, and we would love your prayer support as we do this. One of the great encouragements when I first went to West 7 years ago was I was visited by a very elegant-looking Korean lady called Sungju Kim. And she asked me whether she could speak to my students. And I thought, you know, who is this person? No idea who she was. I guard the opportunities to speak to my students pretty carefully. So I found out a bit about her, her story, how her father had been a shipping magnate in Korea, had in a very typically old-fashioned Korean paternalistic way given his money to his two sons to start their own business, but wouldn't give any money to her. She goes off in a huff to the States. She gets an MBA and a degree in theology. She's a passionate, totally driven Christian woman. She comes back to Europe, and she gets in with the people in the fashion houses in Gucci and Versace. The ladies know about this. I know nothing about it, of course, but there we are. And she introduces these great firms into South Korea. She makes a fortune. She is connected with a church called Sarang Community Church, a modest little church of about 90,000 members. You know how it is in Seoul. Virtually the largest church of almost any denomination you can think of is there in Seoul. Anyway, it's a great church with a huge global vision. And they want to bless Wales. And the story is that the first evangelical martyr in what was the closed kingdom of Korea in the second half of the 19th century, in 1866, a Welshman called Robert Germain Thomas sails in an American gunboat very strange story, not how you would expect the Lord to work, but he did, up the Pyongyang River in what is now North Korea and into a closed kingdom where they didn't want Western expansionism, where they warned them to turn back, but they wouldn't. And eventually that boat was firebombed. Everyone was killed. Robert Jermaine Thomas was executed, beheaded, as he was handing out Bibles in Chinese, this Welshman. And he was the first evangelical martyr there. The Bibles that he was bringing were taken by his executioner and others. The pages were ripped out. They wallpapered their houses with pages from the Bible. People read the pages of the Bible, got converted, formed a church in Pyongyang. And that became greatly blessed by God. There was another Welsh connection. In 1907, there was the first great revival in Korea. That was caught, humanly speaking, from Welsh missionaries in northeast India. And the Korean people, Christians, they do not forget. They have a very, very strong desire to pay back what the spiritual benefit and blessing they got in that way. And that is why that woman was there in Wales. She wanted to bless. She wanted specifically to bless a theological college in Wales. Well, she didn't have a lot of choice. So thankfully, the Lord brought her to us, and we've had since then a fantastic relationship with that church. They've blessed us. They've built a very significant building for us, and they've helped us in many ways. And they're very enlightened. They don't want to Koreanize us at all. They want to learn. They want to send missionaries across to us who could be trained culturally and in every other way how to deal with a post-Christian society. Because just as enlightened Americans are seeing that what is happening in Europe is soon going to be hitting them, so even the Koreans are doing that. Because the Korean story, as you know, Christian-wise in the 20th century, was an amazing story, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. Huge growth. 40% of the population in Korea claiming to be Christian at some point or other. And yet, enlightened evangelical leaders in Korea are saying, look, this is peaking. We can't simply go out and just preach a simple gospel in the way we used to do, have a big meeting and everyone professes Christ. This isn't going to happen anymore. And it isn't. And so a more sophisticated, biblical presentation of the gospel is required. They want to learn from us because it's hitting us first. We are the spiritual front line. That is why the position of our seminary, sort of geopolitically, if you like, in the world is of such crucial importance. And what I'd love you to be able to do is support us as best you can in prayer, because I think we do already have a bit of a relationship. We'd love that to grow. And because you are such a generous-hearted church in prayer and you want to expand, you see the need. I'm so impressed by your leaders who see a lot of what I'm talking about here in Europe and want to get involved and to bless the work there. So that's just such an encouragement. I cannot tell you how much of an encouragement that is to me to know that is the case. So do remember us, please. We're seeking to minister. We're ministering in all sorts of different ways. We have this project called Valley Commandos, which is training people to go up into the valleys. We have other things, if we had time, we could tell you about. But essentially, we're seeking to see from the scriptures how we should be training up the next generation of evangelical leaders to impact not just Wales, but also the rest of the UK and Europe and beyond, if God so wills it. So there we are. Now, Lindsay, I've kept a time. So that's not bad. But thank you for that. And Lindsay's going to take the story on from here.
Thank you. I borrow your watch. I borrow your watch. I haven't got one. Thank you, Jonathan. Well, Jonathan is around until tomorrow, so it will be, if you want to find out more about the challenges of postmodernity in the European context, to see if it matches up with some of the challenges you face, perhaps you could take the opportunity to chat with him. Now, I want to whisk you around the world in the next 30 minutes or so. It'll be a stretch because some of the countries you hear of, you might not have heard their names before. But I wanted to give you an overview of some of the developments and trends in the global evangelical church, perhaps just under about three headings. I did have a PowerPoint, but I left it in an airport 2 days ago. So I think this is being recorded. You'll be able to get it on tape afterwards if you wish. I don't know if you've all had a chance to read the Old Testament prophet. I think you call him Habakkuk. We call him Habakkuk in Wales. It's a remarkable three-chapter prophecy in the Old Testament at a time of spiritual declension amongst the Jews, of violence and hostility amongst neighboring ethnic groups, and warnings of God's impending judgment. It has echoes of our current situation in some ways. But in the midst of the warnings about, repeated warnings about God's judgment in this prophetic book in the Old Testament, there's a beautiful verse in the second chapter where Habakkuk, speaking under the leadership of the Holy Spirit, talks about God's Spirit the word of God. What was the verse in chapter 2, verse 14? The Spirit of God will be across the world as the waters cover the sea. It's an interesting prophetic statement, because at that time there were very few believers in the God of the Bible outside of the nation of, and the people of Israel. But we are seeing the fulfillment of that prophetic statement in our generation. From an historical point of view, the period since 1989 in the world has been, I would suggest, the most remarkable period of growth in the history of the church, even since New Testament times. Now, if you just look at the European context, I think Jonathan is correct. I think it's the toughest continent in the world. And that's why my other job is actually working to develop a team of university evangelists. There are 45 of us working across Europe, and we do about 120 university missions, as we call them, 1 week of evangelism across Europe every year, because we think the university is pivotal. So Europe is tough going. But if you look at the global scene, the church has grown spectacularly in many parts of the world since 1989. 1989 is a key year in history, of course, because it was the year when the Berlin Wall fell. And as a consequence, openings occurred for the proclamation and the propagation of the gospel in as many as 30 or 40 countries where the church was weak, small, or under pressure. Now, in 1910, when a global conference was held on mission in Edinburgh, there were probably no more than 6 or 7 million evangelicals in the world. When the 2010 Congress was hosted in Cape Town, I referred to earlier, that 6 or 7 million had grown to in excess of 300 million evangelicals in the world. In the 1910 Congress, which was looking at mission in the 20th century, 95% of the participants were European or American. In the 2010 Congress, 35% of the global leaders present came from the Western world and 65% from the non-Western world. And that's about the percentage of the evangelical church, the breakdown generally around the world. If I were to ask you what are the five largest evangelical churches by country in the world, see if you can guess what they are. Korea's not one of them, it's number 6. And growth is fairly static, as Jonathan hinted at. What would you guess are the five largest evangelical churches globally in the world today? USA is still one of them, so I'll give you a start. Where else? Sorry? No, Korea would be about 6th, I would say, numerically.
Africa?
In Africa, the church which is the fastest growing is Nigeria. And there's an explosion of growth there. I was in a missions conference for about 6,000 students not too long ago in Nigeria, and I asked some church leaders there, how many Western missionaries are in Nigeria, and how many Nigerian missionaries are in Europe? And he said, well, 20 years ago, we had 4,000 European missionaries in Nigeria and 400 Nigerian missionaries in Europe. Today, it's 4,000 Nigerians in Europe and 400 Europeans in Nigeria. So you see the shift there. It's a fast-growing church, especially in the southern half of the country. Where else? Brazil would be the largest evangelical church in Latin America. Even the Roman Catholic Church statistically says that at least 3,000 people are leaving the Roman Catholic Church and becoming Protestant evangelicals every hour at the moment in Brazil alone. It's an explosive church, and again sending missionaries to many parts of the world. So USA, Nigeria, Brazil, China. China probably now has as many evangelical Christians as the USA. And the turning point probably again was about 1989. Those of you who are over 40 will remember not just the fall of the Berlin Wall, but the Tiananmen Square massacre, which followed on soon after. That was a pivotal point because many students were at the demonstrations in the square in central Beijing. At that time, more than 90% of the English language teachers in China were evangelical Christians. They typically used the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress to teach English. The Chinese government knew that they were Christians, but allowed them to continue to teach because of their high moral standards. So when the students saw how the government behaved in relation to its own people, they said, if this is communism, we want nothing to do with it. Many thousands of them became Christians. And in many other parts of China, of course, the church has grown also. The best statistical evidence we have is from people in the mission agency called OMF, Overseas Missionary Fellowship, used to be China Inland Fellowship. They've done a very careful analysis of the number of believing Christians in each province, by province, done by a guy called Tony Lambert, who used to be a government statistician. He reckons there's a minimum of 60 million evangelicals in China today. The government actually talks about more than 100 million. Now, by comparison, in Britain, it may be 1.2, 1.3 million, but there are a lot more professing Christians in China today. That would be the next country. So China as well, Brazil, Nigeria, USA. Those would be India would be the fifth. In recent years, there's been significant growth, especially amongst the so-called untouchables or the Dalits in India. And I was there just in June for another global congress. And they talked of there being about 30 million evangelical Christians in India today. It's patchy. Some areas of India are seeing explosive church growth. Others is much more resistant. Notice, though, in those five countries, none of them are European. What that highlights is that Europe is the struggling continent. There's significant growth in other parts of the world. Also, the church has become increasingly global in the last 20, 30 years. So you can see Habakkuk's prophecy about God's Spirit, as it were, extending his work as the waters cover the sea to the ends of the earth. That is actually coming into fruition in our generation. Let me just touch on a few other countries which have seen spectacular growth in addition. Perhaps the fastest growing student movement in the world is the country of Ethiopia, where the student evangelical group has grown from 5,000 to 30,000 in just 12 years. I was there not too long ago for another conference, and one of the speakers was a professor of New Testament from Sweden, a very liberal, secularized country. And he'd gone there as a missionary teaching New Testament at 62 years of age. And this is a conference for African leaders with just a few Westerners. I asked him to pray, say grace at the meal table. Very careful, sober, quiet guy. But I noticed there was something special about his prayer. There was real life in it. So I said to him afterwards, I hope you don't mind me asking, but has something happened to you? Because I'd known him for many years. He said, Lindsay, I've been touched by the revival as I met with these Ethiopian brothers and sisters. And he said, you have to understand, for the last 35 years, I've been principal of a seminary, and you get tired of being in debates within the Lutheran churches, as he was, on contemporary issues. And he said, often there are two evangelicals, three who are not. You know, whatever you say, you're going to lose the debate at the end, because they're going to vote against you. So he said, I was worn down by all these pressures and dialogues and debates. But when I came here, the church is alive. He said, you know, the last 6 years, they baptized 200,000 people every year. He said, something remarkable is going on here. So that's Ethiopia in Africa. Let me move to Asia. You all know about Mount Everest in Nepal. The first missionaries went to Nepal only in 1954. There'd never been a church there before, around about the time I was born. First church opened a couple of years later. By 1990, there were about 30,000 known Bible-believing Christians in Nepal. In this congress in Cape Town, Some of the leaders were there. I talked with them and I said, I've heard there's been spectacular church growth in Nepal since 1990. I said, I understand there were 30,000 believers then. And the figure I'm quoting today is 300,000 Bible-believing Christians. Am I accurate? Am I overstating it? He said, no, you've understated it. You can triple it. We are at least 900,000 evangelical Christians, maybe a million. I said, well, how would you account for the spectacular growth of the church in Nepal in the last 20 years or so? He said two things. In 1990-91, when those changes were occurring following the Berlin Wall, many of our pastors were imprisoned. And so ordinary church members, we had to share the gospel, just like in Philippians chapter 1. When Paul was imprisoned, other believers were emboldened to speak. But then he said, it's God's time for us. You've experienced times of refreshing, which we call revival, like Jonathan referred to in Wales. Now it's our turn. And he said, in our church, we don't even go out in the street and give literature or have open air meetings. We just open the windows and the doors. We sing songs and people come in. Well, that's a revival situation. It's not all across the country. Again, it's patchy, but there's significant growth in Nepal. Other countries which have never had an evangelical church have seen significant growth in the last 20 years. Mongolia is one of them, where the great warrior leader Genghis Khan came from. In 1989, there were only 6 known believers in Mongolia. I met at least half of them. They became believers either through radio ministry, they heard it in Russian, the second language, or they came to study in Eastern Europe, in Hungary. They did English language courses there. That's why the easiest place to reach them, we used to send summer teams there. But then when the changes occurred in 89, the church began to, pushing further and further forward, the church began to expand, and there are probably a couple of hundred churches in Mongolia today. Albania would be another one. There were Albanians from Illyricum at the day of Pentecost, but in the 20th century, it was the only country in the world which stated in its constitution that it was atheistic under a leader called Enver Hoxha. When he died in the early 1990s, they had a museum of atheism there even, which was a former church. Very difficult to get into the country. Situation opened up, and today there are about 12,000 evangelical Christians in the country. So here are some of the churches and countries around the world which are experiencing significant growth. Probably the fastest growing church in the Arabic speaking world is Algeria. Again, in Algeria, in North Africa, where Augustine, the great church leader in the early centuries, came from. His mother was a North African. She was a Berber. His father was from Southern Europe. But in the year 2000, there weren't 1,000 evangelical Christians. Today, there are at least 80,000 in Algeria. In the run-up to this Congress, which we had in Cape Town, I met with some of those Algerian leaders in the next country, Tunisia, because it was safer to meet there. While we were having breakfast, the phone went of one of the pastors I was meeting with. It was his wife. She said, I think you better come home. Two of the elders were taken in by the secret police last night. And you'd better come back because the church is feeling under pressure. So he returned. Then he sent me an email a couple of weeks later. He had been cross-examined by the authorities when he returned. And they said to him, if you don't stop proclaiming your message, we'll imprison all you Christians. And he said, I laughed and said to them, it's too late. You could have done that in the year 2000 when we were only 1,000 or less. But now we are 80,000 and you don't have enough places in the prison in which to host us all. So the church is growing there in Algeria, but not one seminary in the whole country, which just shows how critical key seminaries are in other places to help in the equipping and the training of some of these people. So that's the first dimension. From a global perspective, we are actually, though it may not feel like it in North America, and more especially in a European context, if you look at the global church, we are experiencing globally an unprecedented period of the expansion of the church across the globe, which has not been paralleled in any other period in history since the birth of the church in the book of Acts. It's a remarkable time for which we can give thanks as we see prophetic words from Scripture about the globalization of the church taking place in front of our eyes. That's the first thing for which we can be encouraged. and we can rejoice. Of course, it presents many needs from the perspective of training and equipping, because though you may have numerical growth, often there's a lot of superficiality. This is where seminaries and Bible colleges and so on are really critical in the discipleship process. The second trend, however, to be aware of is a rising tide globally of hostility and even overt, open persecution of the church across the world. We shouldn't be surprised at this, because if you read the Acts of the Apostles, you see in Acts chapter 8, the time of Stephen's conversion, significant growth, explosive, but also the persecution of the church. In Acts 11, you see the growth of the church in Antioch, where considerable numbers came to the Lord, but also they were scattered because of persecution. It's often been like that. And on a global scale, we can see in many countries, if it's not overt persecution, you have increasing resistance, hostility, or restriction. You're experiencing some of it in the USA, the first foretaste, as you see resistance in the news, in the media, and so on, increasingly here. We're certainly experiencing it, probably further ahead in the UK context, and freedoms are being eroded for preachers and teachers in the UK context. But in some parts of the world, this persecution is much more overt. Iraq is an example. So is Iran. So is Eritrea. So is even northern Nigeria. Let me give you a couple of illustrations of that. Church in Iran is really one of the fastest growing churches in the world. Many of the churches are underground in home groups. But many key leaders, from recent information, have been imprisoned and even executed in the last 20 years, including several Episcopalian or Anglican bishops who were evangelical Christians in that context. Iraq, the war in Iraq has probably thus far as we can tell, been severely disadvantageous to the church. It may have been beneficial in other ways in trying to bring a democratic system into the country, but actually it has been disastrous for the church, frankly. The only area of Iraq which has profited from the changes in the last 10 years is the north of the country, where the Kurds live, where there's never really been a church. And because the situation has opened up, more missionary teams have been able to go in there and work. But many professing Christians have left Iraq, and some have been killed by hostile Muslims. Let me give you one illustration. I was in Jordan a couple of years back, meeting with leaders from the Middle East, and a guy came into the room. He was a young man I'd met in a student conference in the Arabic world a few years earlier. He was a doctor. I won't say his name because it's being taped. And I said to him, what are you doing here? He was 28. He said, I've come across the border without my passport. And he said, about 6 months ago, some Islamic leaders sent a message to my father, who was the senior elder in the main Presbyterian church in Baghdad, and said, if you continue to serve in your church actively, we're going to kidnap and kill you and your son, who is this boy. So his father said to him, well, we better go to church separately from now on, and not together. After a few months, his father went to the church to do some chores during the day. He was kidnapped, he was tortured, and he was killed. And the mother of this young man said to him, you'll have to cross the border and leave the country, because you're the only son in the family, and I can't face it if I lose you as well as your father. So he said, here I am. Don't even have a passport. I've just smuggled across the border. And in the meeting was an American missionary with me who was working with Muslims in Dubai. And he said to him, said his name, and he said, do you blame American and British soldiers and governments for what happened to your father as a believer? And I was astonished at his response. He said, no, I don't. Because when I read the New Testament, it says, all those who are godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. That's what happened to my father. And then I said to him, well, what are you going to do now? He said, I don't know. One thing I do know, though, is I want to follow the example and the model of my father. That was just 2 years ago in Baghdad. Eritrea is another country many of you may not have heard of. It's one of the newest countries in the world. It was part of Ethiopia. It's now adjacent to it. It's one of the few remaining communist countries in the world. Very hostile to the gospel. Church has been growing there. But the government really gives church leaders a tough time. They've been having skirmishes, even war, with neighboring Ethiopia over the dividing line between the two countries. So what they've done is, and I met with one of the Eritrean church leaders in this congress in Cape Town, who said to me, you know, Lindsay, what they're doing is just what David did with Uriah in the Old Testament. When he wanted to marry Bathsheba, he sent Uriah to the front line so he'd be killed first. He said, that's what the Eritrean government is doing. They are sending pastors who don't even know how to hold a gun, with no training, to the front line so that when there are skirmishes with the Ethiopian army, many of our pastors are being killed. And then this church leader said, the other thing they've done recently is horrific. They got one of these big containers. They put a number of pastors in it, and they dug a hole in the ground, put the container in it, and the pastors were smothered underground as a consequence. She said, my husband's a pastor. I see him about once every 3 months. He has to sleep in a different home every night because he's been followed and chased by the secret police. That's happening in our world at the moment. Overt persecution. But then there are other forms of restriction and hostility also. One of the philosophical worldviews which is responsible for creating the environment you and I are living in is the growth of so-called pluralism and relativism. I went to see the great Anglican church leader John Stott just before he died a couple of years ago, because he was the vice president of the organization I work for. And I said to him, John, what do you think are the biggest challenges facing the global church? This is just before he died, at the beginning of the 21st century. And he said, number one, pluralism and relativism. First cousins. Pluralism is the worldview that there are a plurality of sources or ways to the truth. No one way. So that when Christians say Jesus is the only way or is unique, we are accused of being racist or arrogant. And that is distinctive to the culture in which we live. The United States is dominated educationally by a pluralistic worldview. And its first cousin is relativism. Everything is relative. The only absolute is that there are no absolutes. Everybody's entitled to their view, and they're all equally valid. No one is superior to the other. That is the world which increasingly dominates your culture and has been dominating our culture increasingly for many, many decades, going back really to the so-called Enlightenment period. It wasn't particularly enlightened, but the Enlightenment period in Europe in the 18th century. And that has pervaded our cultures increasingly over the last 200 years. So pluralism and relativism dominates our cultures. In fact, one Christian theologian said recently that the tension between science and Christianity is like child's play, or will be seen to be like child's play, in relation to the threat of pluralism and relativism in our culture. And actually, that is often the case. Now, alongside that, another increasingly overt form of opposition is the growth of Islamic fundamentalism, and in India, Hindu fundamentalism, because there's a political party in India, the BJP, who are really hostile to Christians and would like to restrict the growth of the church. They were in power for a few years. They lost the elections a few years ago. Many Christians were praying for that, but it's possible they may come back to power, in which case there'll be a lot of pressure on Indian Christians. But Islamic fundamentalism also, you can see it rearing its head in Egypt, in Syria, in Iran, and so on. And there are elements of it even in your country and mine, as Islamic immigration increases into our cultures. Now, in the early 1990s, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was an American writer of Japanese origin called Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book called The End of History. Anybody read it? Oh, he was a bestseller in the States. I saw it in airports wherever I went. Made him a millionaire. Became very wealthy, still teaching in university. It was rubbish. And actually, it was naive. What he said was, history is over. The West has won. The democratic worldview has won over. There's no other competing system that's left. The game is over. It was nonsense. But many Westerners wanted to believe in the triumph of the Western worldview. Made him a very wealthy man. Still, sometimes you see him on television commentating. But it was nonsense. Someone else later on, later in the 90s, called Samuel Huntington in the States, wrote another book trying to describe what we're experiencing in the world. We call it the clash of civilizations. He's much more on the button. He said what we're going to face is a clash of civilizations between those cultures that have been impacted and shaped by the Judeo-Christian worldview on the one hand, and the growth of Islamic fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, and so on the other. So that's another element of opposition. But the other, which is coming your way, and we've got it in heavy doses in our universities, is the new atheism, espoused by people like Christopher Hitchens, then several science professors like Richard Dawkins in Oxford University. And this is a new form of atheism, because what they're saying is this. They're not just saying they think that religious faith, especially Christian faith, is untrue or is useless. They're actually saying they think religious belief, and especially faith in Jesus Christ as a resurrected Savior, they think it's nonsense and evil to do so. Because they say out of these religious worldviews come some of the tensions we see in the world. It's growing in hostility, and it's on our universities. And often in the past, the church has retreated from this kind of opposition. And if we continue to do so, we will do so at our peril. Historically, the best way to respond to these opposing worldviews is you have to take them on in public. And that is why working in universities is critical. That is why Christians speaking on television, in dialogue, on radio, in the newspapers is important. There's been a stream of theology governing many churches in the West called Pietism. It's a good stream of theology. It's a worldview which speaks about devotion to the person of Christ. But we have to go beyond Pietism to being engaged in developing what some theologians call a Christian mind, by which I mean an attempt to apply biblical truth to every sphere of society and demonstrate the superiority of the truth claims of the gospel. Often, as we've retreated into just separatist Christian schools, universities, and so on, we've left the wider world, the open canvas, we've left it to non-Christians where they've taken up residence because we haven't articulated and defended the gospel in the public sphere. Now, historically, if you look at the Reformation in the 16th century with Luther and Calvin, and if you look at the growth of the church between the end of the first of the New Testament and the coming of Constantine in about 300 years later, what church historians say is this. Adolf Harnack was a great German church historian. He said the reason that the early church grew in those first 300 years is because they outlived the pagans by godly living, and they out-argued them by demonstrating and speaking in public about the superiority of the truth claims of the Bible in terms of what it says about family life, in terms of what it says about sexuality, the workplace, medicine, education, ethics, every areas of life. When you retreat from that, paganism and secularism takes over. And then if you look at the 16th century and the Reformation, there's a fair argument for saying Calvin and Luther weren't only just preaching in public, they were involved in many, many public dialogues in trying to demonstrate the superiority of the truth claims of the gospel. And historically, you can argue that the church in Europe was transformed through this Reformation period because they penetrated the universities. That's why Charles Malik, one time president of the Council in the United Nations, said, if you want to change the world, start with a university. You've got to start there because that's the fulcrum of ideas which eventually penetrate and dominate our culture. So this is the second trend globally. On the one hand, you see remarkable growth around the world. On the other hand, increasing restrictions, sometimes overt persecution. And then thirdly and lastly, while we've seen significant growth of the church globally, nevertheless, there are still great challenges facing us in terms of reaching the unreached. Let me just highlight three or four for your consideration as you think about mission and your support of mission in this church. Though we see this significant growth globally, there are still areas of the world where Christian presence and the life of the church is totally absent. In the first Lausanne Congress, which Billy Graham hosted in 1974, there was an American missionary working in Central America called Ralph Winter. He gave a talk of only 15 minutes, but it profoundly affected the way missions have been carried on the last 30 or 40 years. He said this, and he was speaking to a gathered crowd of 2,500 evangelical leaders from around the world. He said, many of you talk about the gospel being taken to the nations. When Jesus said, declare the gospel amongst the nations, we think in terms of nation states, a political entity, like the USA, like Guatemala, like Mexico, like the UK. Those are nation states. But those are constructs only of the last 200-300 years. He said, when the Bible talks about the gospel being proclaimed amongst the nations, it doesn't mean nation states. The Greek word used is ethne, an ethnic group. And you may have many hundreds of ethnic groups which are determined by their language in one country at one time. Nigeria has many scores of different ethnic groups speaking different languages. There are thousands of ethnic groups, ethne groups around the world, but only about 220 countries. If you think in terms of ethne, there are 639 people groups with a population of 100,000 who do not have any believers amongst them, have never had a missionary, do not have one verse translated into their language, no spiritual songs, no home groups, no church buildings, nothing. They've never had it. And apparently, so missiologists say, there are 390 million people in the world like that. So we argue about the second coming. They've never heard about the first coming. That's still the reality amongst some ethnic groups around the world. That's why 25 years ago in Fuller Seminary, a group of people started to develop a program called Adopt a People. And that has profoundly affected the mission budgets of many churches in North America. It's barely touched the UK scene. But their argument was this: we need to recalibrate and have a balance between supporting what already exists and pioneering where nothing exists. And the vast majority of the church's income, more than 90%, is spent on maintenance and training and equipping, and less than 10% in the world on pioneering and evangelism. So many churches, especially progressive churches in the States, started to say that we will adopt a people, an ethnic group, which has never had the gospel, and challenge our membership to consider sending someone from our group to penetrate that group. And in that sense, the American Evangelical Church has made a significant contribution in the last 30 years. The number of ethnic groups without the church has diminished by 300%, mainly because of these American missionaries over the last 30 years. It's hardly impacted UK at all. We're still working on an old paradigm, unfortunately. I need to take a fresh look. The other dimension to it is the large number of people who have never had the scriptures in their language. United Bible Societies, International Bible Society, the American Bible Society, Wycliffe Bible Society say there are close to 7,000 languages in the world, but only 2,500 of them, maybe a third, have portions of scripture in their own language. And maybe 400 million don't even have access to the scriptures in a second language in which they could speak. So they're actually joining together to try to begin a translation of the scripture into all the main remaining languages by 2025. So you have these unreached people groups people who have never heard the gospel before. That's one of the challenges facing us. Another is the university scene, as I've mentioned. If you look at any culture, it's very interesting how the culture, the direction of the culture, is shaped and dominated often by people who've had the privilege of a university education. In this global congress in Cape Town, 60% of the speakers had a background in student and university mission. Often, people who go to university dominate the media later on, not necessarily the business world. Many top business leaders haven't been to university. But the media often is dominated by people who've been to university, and they're often educated in the West in liberal circles. When I see the BBC in Britain, I see people I was in university with, commentating, reading the news, speaking, they were often leftists, Marxists, or very liberal in university, and they have hardly changed their worldview, and they're very hostile to the gospel. I was doing an interview on the BBC radio the other day, and the guy interviewing me, whom I knew well, said to me, well, you've got this congress in Cape Town, and you're working with students. Tell us why many students are coming to hear Christian meetings in the UK. And I thought, this is a great opportunity to share the gospel. So I dived in to try and say something about the gospel. He turned the tape off straight away. I said, what are you doing? Because it was a recorded message. He said, I know what you're going to say. You're going to speak about Jesus' deity, death, and resurrection. And he said, I don't want to give you any airtime. I said, I thought the BBC was supposed to be fair in allowing all views to be aired. He said, no, we only want to hear what's new. We don't want to hear what you evangelicals believe. So we're not giving you any time. So it's all very well to say it's important to be on the in the media in terms of communicating Christian truth, but often people running it have a very liberal perspective, and it's often been shaped when they're in university. And we have only ourselves to blame if we're not trying to reach these people when they're at a university level. So that's some of the needs. Some of the other needs would be the growth of the mega cities and the challenge of communicating the gospel in that context. The expansion of the diaspora, people leaving their own cultures and going to other cultures. This has two dimensions to it. I should close in a few moments for questions. But the diaspora, people who are usually immigrants or coming from other cultures, often there are believers amongst them. Sometimes it causes problems with immigration and so on. But amongst the diaspora, often from other cultures coming to our nation, you will find some people who are already believers who bring the gospel to them. And this is why the church in France is growing today. Church in France has grown from 4,000 evangelicals in 1910 to 250,000 in 1985 when I was living in Paris to 475,000 evangelical Christians today. Nearly double in 25 years. And a major reason for the growth of the church there is the contribution of people coming from other cultures. Four of the 10 largest churches in London are led by people who were immigrants into the culture who brought the gospel with them. So on the one hand, there can be the negative. On the other, God is using the diaspora to contribute to the growth of the church in many cultures also. I'll give you just one illustration. I should close with this just for your encouragement. A friend of mine, she's gone to heaven now, but she was a single lady in her 60s. I used to travel throughout the Middle East trying to share the gospel amongst Muslims. She was a rather inoffensive-looking lady, quite large, never married, but she used to drift through airports, never checked out, because she looked like a granny, so they never suspected anything, but she was a missionary. And she told me how once she was in Saudi Arabia, which is resistant to the gospel, and she was invited into the home of a woman she knew, a Muslim woman, who was wearing the veil, just to have some coffee and some food. And they were talking, and this Muslim lady said to her, Vivian, would you come down and see the new room downstairs that my husband and I have built in the house? And she thought, well, out of courtesy, I'll just go down and see it. I'm not that interested, but I don't want to be offensive and say no. So she went downstairs with this Muslim lady. And as they came down to the room, not much smaller than this, she put the switch on. The light came on. There were 70 or 80 people in the room. So she turned to this friend, Vivian, who was from the UK. And Vivian said, well, who are all these people? And she said, they've come here to hear you speak about Isa, Jesus, from the Injil, the gospel. And Vivian said, well, it's illegal to do that in the country. I can be beheaded for doing it. Who are they? She said, well, they are seekers after the truth about Jesus in the gospels. And Vivian said, well, how did this come about? She said, well, you know that 3 years ago, I employed a Filipina maid, almost working like a slave. And she said, this maid from the Philippines would come here to work and get some money. She was always singing around the house. She said, you know, I never leave the house because I'm housebound because of the restrictions of our culture. And after a while, I said to this Filipina maid, why are you singing so much? And what are you singing about? Why are you so joyful? She said to me, I'm singing songs of praise and thanksgiving to Jesus, who is my Savior, Redeemer, resurrected. He gives me hope and he gives me joy. And this Muslim lady said to the Filipina maid, well, tell me how to get that joy. I'd like to have it too. So she said, shared with me about Isa, Jesus, in the gospel. And she said, my heart was warmed. And I became a believer and a follower in Isa, Jesus. Then I told my husband. He decided to follow Jesus. Then our children. Then we shared this message with our wider extended family and our neighbors. This is who these people are. Most of them are not yet believers, but they are fascinated by the joy we have found in the person of Isa. And it all started because of one immigrant Filipina. Well, if you look at the New Testament, the two ways that God worked missiologically were that he either sent people to other peoples, or he brought people away from their home to another culture, which was unsettling and opened them to other worldviews. If you read the Acts of the Apostles, only two or three people were converted at home. You check it out. Read Acts of the Apostles again. Nearly everyone, including Saul and others, Cornelius, the people in the day of Pentecost from 17 different languages, all converted away from home. That must say something to us about the opportunities we have to connect with and communicate the gospel amongst people who come to live in our country from elsewhere when they're reevaluating their value system, and to make use of and create space for believers who come from other cultures who are integrated in our churches to encourage them to bear witness to Christ. So these are some of the opportunities and the challenges facing us at the beginning of the 21st century. On the one hand, great growth. On the other hand, restriction, even overt persecution. And then thirdly, still many needs and opportunities. And we need to reflect on those as we put our mission budget together, as we think about how we're going to serve, fulfill Christ's mandate, take the gospel into the ends of the earth from our local church context. Well, may God give you grace as you seek to do that. We've got 5 minutes for a couple of questions, or is time gone? Pardon? Any questions? Is there a country you're interested in I haven't spoken of?
I'm just interested, since you said we're about 10 years or so behind you, what do we have to expect from the Asian term hostile Muslims that are starting to immigrate into our country?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can't speak of Muslims as being a block of people all the same, any more than you could say that all Americans are the same. You have nice Americans, you have nasty Americans. You have generous, you have kind Americans, you have offensive Americans. In any culture, you have a mixture of people. To be fair to those who come from Muslim backgrounds, there are some very lovely, engaging Muslim people. Even in Egypt, in the tensions in recent months, some of my Christian friends have been defended by sympathetic Muslim neighbors who have prevented some members of the Islamic Brotherhood from actually killing some of my friends in Egypt. They've actually laid their lives on the line to protect them. But there is this group, the Islamic Brotherhood and other extreme groups, often funded from within Iran elsewhere, whose goal really is the formation of a caliphate, something which occurred hundreds of years ago, where the Islamic faith is dominant over a culture. And that is their vision for the whole world, for the UK and for the USA eventually. Their vision is not necessarily peaceful coexistence. Some Muslims are committed to that, but some of the more extreme groups, their vision is the formation of a caliphate. That's the tension that you saw in Egypt, where you had this particular group who were voted into power, many Muslims who were not aware of this kind of worldview of the Islamic Brotherhood were shocked by their behavior subsequently, and actually even Muslims turned against that system of government, which is why it was brought down. If you like, it was a coup by democratic means when they came to power. And so the resistance to the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt has been as much from moderate Muslims as it has been from Christians. That's how they were brought down, really. So there's that tension. But within the Islamic Brotherhood, there's definitely a concern to Islamicize and take over a culture, and they definitely don't believe in democracy. So you'll have those tensions within the Islamic or the Muslim community. Some who want to integrate, some who want to engage, some will want to live alongside those who have different worldviews and aspirations, but some who really want to transform the political and religious direction of a culture. And so we should expect growing influence from some of those people. That's what's happening in France and the UK, where the percentage of Muslims is much higher than here. France, it's about 6 million people now from Muslim countries. UK is probably about 3 and growing in numbers.
What is the state of the church in South Africa?
Well, it's very mixed. There is a lot of nominalism, like some of our Western cultures, which arises often from superficial biblical teaching, or arises from the fact that the political situation was so charged for many years, many of the preachers were radicalized politically, and they lost focus on the gospel and focused perhaps more on political change. There are a number of very fine Bible teachers, however, in South Africa, including we're beginning to see the growth of some black South Africans who are missionary statesmen. I was just with one of them a few weeks ago, who have a passion for the wider world. In the white community, there are also some very fine evangelical leaders. One of the most outstanding is a man called Michael Cassidy, who's now in his late 70s. He's the founder of Africa Enterprise, which is committed to evangelistic missions all across Africa. In fact, under the auspices of Lausanne at the moment, he's hosting an evangelistic mission or a week of evangelism in every capital city in Africa over the next few years, and it's being led from South Africa. So it's a rather mixed situation. A lot of liberal theology, which is not biblical, a lot of superficiality, some larger charismatic churches, but perhaps a lack of depth often in teaching.
Increase in Islam versus Christianity here in the United States, in the UK, and then worldwide?
Yeah. I don't know the figures for the USA, I'm afraid, but it's certainly the case that the number of the Islamic presence in the UK is, you can see it's following what's happened earlier in France because of France's colonial links with North Africa. You had many people from Algeria, Tunisia, and so on coming into France, so larger numbers there, and we're catching up in Britain. In Britain, the Muslims tend to come in amongst the immigrants, particularly from Pakistan, former colonies. So our colonial past is biting us back as people from some of those countries come in. And the birth rate is much higher, so the population is growing faster. And I think it's a challenge for Christians to work out, you know, what immigration policy a government should have. The Bible very clearly says that we should love the alien. It's the word the Leviticus uses. We should love the alien as we love ourselves. We should care for those who are oppressed or are poor or who come from other countries. So there needs to be an openness to those who are poor or needy who come to our country or asking for help. Secondly, however, because of the reality of the fall in human nature, there needs to be a realistic policy of controlled immigration in a culture. It seems to me that many of our cultures, many of our political leaders have been weak at that level. And in Britain, in the 1990s, we just had a chaotic immigration policy where it was open doors and anybody came in who wanted to. And the reality is that the vast majority of people in their fallenness can't handle that level of rapid change. So it needs to be more moderately controlled. So there's this creative tension that Christians have to hold. Caring for and open to and welcome to those who are of other cultures, especially those who are believers, but also recognizing that often when people come away from home, they become believers if they come to the UK. On the other hand, a realistic immigration policy which restricts the speed and the numbers in the change, because cultures can't handle rapid change where you're grafting on or trying to bring together several ethnic groups. And what we call in Britain multiculturalism, the practice the government has practiced over the years, last 30 years, of trying to make space for different ethnic groups to live in their communities, but side by side, it doesn't work. Actually, most people think that's broken down now. It's got to be a better form of integration somehow, or you get increasing numbers of riots and tension. But very few politicians are brave enough and creative enough to work in trying to respond to those challenges. It is complex. It's not easy and straightforward. So we can't, in a blanket way, say we're opposed to immigration, because clearly, biblically, many people became believers away from home. And we're told to care for the alien. I lived as an outsider in another country for 6 years, and I experienced the kindness and generosity of Christians when I couldn't even speak the language. It's a wonderful thing when that kindness is shown. People often, their hearts open to the gospel. On the other hand, we need to be realistic about our capacity to adjust to such significant change. One more, King.
This large influx of Muslims into France and to England, is that a purposeful strategy by countries, or is that just people looking for better economics?
Mm-hmm. Well, it may be both. I think the reality is that many people have moved into France and the UK because of the colonial links between some of those countries and the UK and France in the past. France effectively colonized some of the North African countries. And so people were able to have, if you like, almost dual nationality as a result. Then you had the Algerian War in the 60s with many people leaving, coming to France, and the Algerian ethnic community growing there for in France. So the vast majority of Muslims in France come from former colonies, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, North Africa. 3/4 of all the Muslims in France come from those countries. There are hardly any people from those countries in the UK. Very, very few. Most people with an Islamic background in the UK come from former UK colonies, especially Pakistan. So it's a consequence of some of the approaches we took vis-a-vis colonization in the past, with people feeling that there's a linkage, and if you like, the colonizing country owes it to those countries which they colonized in the past. At the same time, behind that, you have political Islamic leaders who clearly, especially in places like Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, clearly have this vision of the Islamicization of the world and the formation of a global caliphate, and they clearly have a vision for Islamicizing all cultures, including our own. So you have the two things at the same time, and often they will then try to stoke this influence. So Saudi Arabia and others will typically give lots of money to pay for the construction of mosques in many places. So they pour money into France and the UK to create these new mosques, many hundreds of them. And that gives face to the presence of Islam in our cultures as well. And then, of course, politicians in our countries tend to take a weak line because they want to get voted in. So they're not so open about the real challenges we face. And instead of just branding people, trying to put together political programs which are carefully thought out in terms of how to respond to the complexity of the situation. And for that, you need statesmen and stateswomen. We don't have many of them. So we need to pray that God will raise up such people. Last comment in that respect, if I may. One of the challenges in global evangelicalism also is the lack of what I would call evangelical statesmen. There's a huge proliferation of denominations and mission agencies, many mission agencies doing exactly the same as other groups. And what we really need to see at a global level, and there are very few people like this, John Stott was, Billy Graham was, people who are evangelical statesmen who are driven more by a concern for the advance of the gospel and the kingdom of God than they are for their own ministry or their own denomination. They tell you the two key marks of an evangelical statesman are these. First of all, they genuinely rejoice whenever the gospel goes forward, no matter who's leading, no matter who's on the platform. And secondly, you talk to these people, and often they're telling you, isn't it wonderful what God is doing through so-and-so or so-and-so? And after half an hour, you have to say to them, excuse me, but can you tell me what you're doing? Because you haven't said anything about it yet. Because
their mindset is they want to see the gospel advanced, and they don't mind if they are not leading it, if they're standing behind. Those people are very rare. We have almost none in my country. And it was very interesting when we had the Lausanne Congress. We decided to find a statesman in each country in the world to select people to come. There weren't any in some countries, and in some cases we were ashamed when all some people would do would be invite members of their family or their church or their denomination. They weren't thinking about the wider evangelical constituency. We desperately need, in our generation, people who are evangelical statesmen and women who are dominated by a concern for the advance of Christ's gospel and his glory, even if they're not leading and if they're in the shadows. Pray for such people.
I think that sounds like a call for us, right? So thank you, Lindsay and gentlemen. You guys will be around for a few questions. Come up. And you're dismissed. We'll see you next week.